Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So we are coming to the end of the first week back for MPs in Parliament, and this is the week that the Chancellor has begun to be the subject of many negative stories. Rishi Sunak has in many ways enjoyed something of a honeymoon. It didn't feel like a honeymoon in the sense there was a pandemic going on and various emergency measures, but he has definitely emerged in recent months as the most popular politician in this Tory government. But this week he's been trying to land the message to his party that there could be some difficult decisions coming up the track, and talking about potential tax rises, though not a horror show, because ultimately the party needs to maintain its reputation for economic competence. Fraser, in your Telegraph column today, you begin to come to the Chancellor's defence. He's had a lot of negative headlines, but you say what he's trying to do is to point out that if the Tories want to keep spending this way, decisions are going to have to be made which are not going to be ones with easy answers. What do you mean in the piece?
Well, I have to say that I am not particularly wild on the sort of tax rises he's proposing. I think high taxes make everyone poorer. And listen, the discussion in Sweden right now, for example, is tax cuts to give the economy a stimulus it needs. That's what I would favour. But I think Rishi Sunak is quite right to tell his party that there are some pretty tough decisions lying ahead. I mean, they are all right now spending like drunken Keynesians. If something moves, then you throw money after it. If there's a problem, they write a cheque. This is the default Tory mindset. HS2, great, let's go forward. Education problem, let's throw £1 billion at it, even if this particular problem in schools doesn't respond to money. So when the knee-jerk Tory reaction is to spend, 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 it's not, I think, unfair for the Chancellor to say, well, spending after spending comes taxation. Right now, the Tory party believes in the magic money tree. The thing which they spent the last general election saying didn't exist is now alive and planted in the back of 11 Downing Street. They are borrowing amazing amounts. When I was writing the piece, I found out that Rishi Sunak has borrowed more in his first 5 months as Chancellor than Gordon Brown did in 10 years as Chancellor. And right now, interest rates are very low, which makes the Tories think that there's never going to be a bill to pay for this. You can just take out a new MasterCard to pay off your Visa bill, or in the old days, there's never going to be a moment of truth. And of course, there will be. And now, I don't think that Rishi Sunak wants high taxes. I just think he's saying that the Conservatives as a party cannot rely on debt to fill the gap between how much they can bring themselves to tax and how much they want to spend. They need to align those two things. That here's the thing, the manifesto has ruled out VAT increases, has ruled out income tax increases. So what does that leave? Only a handful of things. It leaves taxing on the self-employed, it leaves pension raids, it leaves perhaps some wealth taxes or property taxes, but that will not make up the gap. Where I think this is going is the Tories having to tear up their manifesto pledge not to raise income tax. That's going to be a difficult. I think Rishi Sunak was wrong to say to them it's not going to be a horror show, because I think it is. These chickens will be coming home to roost pretty soon. The government's going to do a spending review. It's going to have to work out how it's going to pay for these bills it's been so happy to write. And that is not going to be a happy process.
James, whether it's a horror show or just a few brief unpleasant measures, do you think that this is something the Tory party is going to be receptive to? Are the Chancellor's words having any effect yet? Because even if you look at the smaller measures, many of which being mooted, that Fraser just touched on, they're getting a very negative response. When I tweeted a blog on this, which asked the question, the headline, will Tory MPs back tax rises? I think within about 3 minutes, I had Lucy Allen, Jacob Rees-Mogg's PPS, reply just saying no, full stop. Where do you think the party sits?
I mean, the Tory MPs do not want tax rises. But I think it's worth unpacking this a little bit. I mean, there are three separate questions here, right? So the first is, people talk about, you know, the borrowing that has been taken out in response to the pandemic, so to pay for the furlough and things like that. I think the government can quite comfortably just say, right, we'll pay that back over 50, 60, 70 years. You know, treat it like a wartime debt that gets paid back over a very long period of time. The second question is, how are you going to pay for all of these infrastructure projects? Again, I think on things like that, which are going to add to the productive value of the economy, I think you can quite comfortably borrow to fund those kind of capital projects. The tricky issue is what happens if, and it still is an if, because I don't think we know yet for certain, if the economy is permanently smaller after COVID and the UK carries on spending the same amount of money, the UK would be running a deficit on its day-to-day spending. And I think the markets are very happy to be very tolerant of lots of things. But a deficit on day-to-day spending with no plan for how to close it could elicit a bit of negative reaction in the market. And I think the point Fraser makes in his piece is that reaction doesn't have to be massively negative. It doesn't have to be the UK having to spend, you know, 8% to get its debt away. It just has to push it up from the current extremely low levels to 1% or 2%. For it to put to blow a big hole in the government's finances. So I think that is the tricky question. And I think one of the dangers is that everyone is thinking about the things that you need to spend more money on because of COVID, but not the things that maybe you need to spend less money on because of COVID. So, I mean, interesting example today, you know, spades went into the ground on HS2. It's now, you know, past the point of no return. But the real argument for HS2 has always been, and it's an argument I was personally quite persuaded by, a capacity argument. You needed more capacity on that line. I'm not sure that you do now, because I don't think in 10 years' time, a businessman from London who wants to go to Birmingham for a meeting or vice versa is going to take the train anymore. I think they are going to zoom in. I think people have just got used to that now. And I mean, that means that we should ask some questions about that spending. I think the danger is that things permanently get added to the national spending ledger. So let's build this, do this post-COVID. And no one thinks about the savings that might actually be possible because the way people are working is changing. And so maybe that changes some of the things that the state needs to provide in terms of infrastructure and services.
And Fraser, when we look at factors which could change the economic outlook, one thing you mentioned in your Telegraph column is the stress test officials in the Treasury carried out. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. At the beginning of the pandemic, we saw the government's gilt rates, in other words, how much interest it has to pay in its borrowing, rise to 1%. Doesn't sound like much, but that would have put the government in real trouble. That's why the Bank of England intervened with all of this quantitative easing to get the interest rates right down to 0.2%. Now, what the Treasury did a few weeks ago was to do a little exercise. Let's say the Bank of England stops QE and interest rates go back to 1%, hardly a high rate. What would then happen? The result was that it would cost tens of billions of pounds because the interest you'd be paying of a debt would go up by a factor of 5 from 0.2% up to 1%. That illustrated just how much of a tightrope the government is on right now. Now, when Sajid Javid was Chancellor, he was quite relaxed about this. He had this phrase, low for long, basically thinking that this era of very low interest rates are going to be with us for the foreseeable future. I don't think Rishi Sunak is as relaxed about that. Certainly the Treasury is not as relaxed. That's why it's doing these stress tests. And the test is simply a reminder of how close the government is to really serious financial problems. All it would take is for interest rates to go away from the artificially low levels right now back to even a little bit of what they're like historically, and you've got a government fairly soon running into financing problems.
Now, James, in other news, the decision that many were waiting for came yesterday on the weekly quarantine update on holidays or trips even abroad. Despite lots of talk that Portugal could be placed on that list, have its air bridge revoked, and as someone who's feeling quite smug when they managed to get back from Portugal quite earlier on in the week, actually, there was no change whatsoever. So it's still the case that if you live in England, you can go to Greece, you can go to Portugal, you can come back, and you don't have to quarantine. But in various parts of the UK, you have different rules for these countries. And it does mean it's getting quite confusing. So why is it that we have a situation where the Westminster government has decided to go for different quarantine measures than Scotland and Wales?
To go back to the original origin of this problem, it is because Westminster didn't understand how the devolution settlement worked. When the government first came up with the idea of quarantine, it assumed that because this was a measure to do with borders, it was reserved. In other words, what the UK government decided would apply across the whole of the UK. Actually, quarantine is enforced under a public health provision, and public health is a devolved matter, meaning that we now have separate regimes in Scotland and Wales to that in England. And I think that is responsible for some of the confusion. I think the next problem is there is no clear criteria for what gets a country put onto this quarantine list or not. And I think that is confusing. I mean, there's also an issue that the government is determined to stick to treating countries on a kind of national level rather than a local level, which I think is rather odd, given that the entire policy here is local lockdowns. It seems, you know, Fraser's written about this very eloquently. He went on holiday in Croatia. Where he was in Croatia, there was a very, very low level of COVID. In another part of Croatia, quite some distance away, there was a problem. And yet the UK quarantine policy didn't distinguish between that, which seemed particularly ham-fisted, given that nearly all UK tourists in Croatia were on the coast where there wasn't a problem rather than being inland. So I think this is the issue is, I don't mean to come over overly libertarian here, I do find the arbitrariness of this quite difficult, that, you know, that people have, you know, such potential disruption, and that, you know, you suddenly get, it's like a government-run game show, you know, you've got 36 hours to return from France using planes, trains, or automobiles, and if you don't make it back, you've got 2 weeks stuck at home.
Well, can I just say, some people love that game. I mean, like, take our colleague Kate Andrews, right? She told me the other day that she regards it as a challenge. I mean, she was off in Portugal with Katie last weekend, wasn't it, right? And
now she's in Greece.
And now she basically looks around, like, okay, where can I go before the government comes down again on Friday?
She's actually got a very bad record. I think it's going slightly better for her because she initially was in Spain, which closed.
But she made then it she just under the wire, didn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, she got back just in time, then it closed. Yeah. She went to France, then it closed. But actually, she seems to have broken the curse now.
So in the old days, it used to be bad news if you saw Kate Adie turn up in your country because it meant there was famine coming. If you now see Kate Andrews turn up, it means quarantine is coming.
Yeah, I think I might have cursed brutal Croatia as well because they got the bullet a couple of weeks after I came back. And you know what really, I mean, when I was in Croatia, what they fail to understand is just how this is devastating for countries like Croatia. It is not a rich place. You've got people out there who make losses all of the year. Their whole livelihood depends on being able to run a profit for about 2 or 3 months during the summer. Now, the 20 cases per 100,000 residents, that is not high. And the worst thing was that the, you know, where I was staying on the Dalmatian coast, it was the safest place in the Mediterranean for COVID. The problem was inland next to Serbia. And yet, if you're looking at this from a government spreadsheet, you think, okay, this is terrible, let's put the... And the people who suffer for this will be these poor people in this country which are still recovering from its lost decade of civil war, desperately trying to rebuild and to come on a level of prosperity with the West. And we are stopping this with this idiotic quarantine system, which is very difficult to defend on any objective measures. And it's causing real misery to many of our European friends and cousins out there. And, you know, when the former Yugoslavia joined the EU, I thought that was a great thing. The whole thing is we work together in the comity of Europe. I mean, sure, after Brexit, it doesn't stop Britain reaching out. We ought to be doing a lot more to reach out to countries on the periphery, countries in Western Europe who still haven't quite managed to come up to our levels of prosperity and help them. But instead, we're reacting in this way and we're cutting off the lifeline of Dalmatia, which is the tourist industry. So I have a whole bunch of problems with the way the government's carrying this out.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening. And while we have you here, you presumably heard about it in advance, but just in case you didn't make it, yesterday we launched The Week in 60 Minutes of Andrew Neil. It's now available to watch on Catch Up if you go to spectator.co.uk/TV. And we'll also be doing it all again next week, so make sure you sign up when the details are announced.